Oh, I was going to look up how I, it's been long enough that I don't remember how I intro the podcast. So one moment. Frames, what's our website address? Keyframespodcast.podcast.cast. Keyframespodcast.com. Oh! Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and with me today are Andy.
Hey.
Duncan.
Hello.
And John.
Hello.
It's a new anime season, as was pointed out to me. I need help with that because I don't actually stay up to date with anime. I'm always watching stuff that's 10
every 3 months.
10 years old.
It's every 3 months.
Every three months. So is anyone watching anything new or old that's good? John, I know that you're watching like a billion shows.
I watched a billion shows, and now I'm currently watching a billion more shows. Jeez. I don't really know. I guess...
Don't you love anime, though?
No.
This is a podcast for people who love anime, so you have to love anime.
I do love how anime is the only form of media that comes out, like, starts and stops after every 3 months. I think that's really good for some odd reason. I really love that.
It is nice, but also it's like really structured, so you are guaranteed to get 12 to 13 episodes for every 3 months. Like, it's weird. I don't know, whatever. Anyway, I guess I... Okay, so the season...
It shouldn't be hard, man.
The season ended.
It shouldn't
so
be hard.
I finished a whole bunch of stuff, and then the season started, so I started a whole bunch of stuff. But right in between there, during this past week, over a course of three nights, I watched 22 episodes of Your Lie in April, because it was really good and really engrossing.
Yeah, I've been wanting to watch that, but I don't know. Every time that I'm sold on it, it looks on paper like something I'd love, but it also looks like it could be just horrible crying drama. It makes me think of, like, Anno Hana or something, which I don't want to watch ever again.
I don't know how it compares
to There's a live-action drama of that now.
Yeah,
well,
that's all.
Great. One more piece of media I'll never watch in my life.
Maybe it'll be better, though. Maybe you'll like it more.
No, I can't fall in that trap. You're lying, April.
Yeah, I don't know how that compares to Anohana. I have not seen Anohana in a very long time. I remember liking Anohana, but I was also significantly younger. That said, Your Lie in April does fall into the trap that a lot of anime falls into, where the kids act way too fucking mature for their age. Like, these kids are 14, and they act like adults, and that's weird. But once you get over that, it's really good. Like, it's about this kid who, he has real problems playing, like, he used to play piano a lot, and he, like, can't do it anymore. It's like a mental block. And he meets this girl who is very eccentric and happy all the time, and like she plays the violin, and she like forces him to get into playing piano. It's definitely an emotional ride. I don't know how much I can say because I don't really want to spoil it, and it's kind
of course
difficult. I don't know. It was really good. Like, I watched it over the course of three nights, so obviously something in it grabbed me. I will say that I tear up a lot because I'm a baby, but I'd very rarely like outright cry, and this one brought me just to the edge, and it was very good. It's also very pretty. Like, it's one of the better animated series I've seen that of this sort of like setting. Like, you know, it's just kids playing music, and it's got great music. It's got a lot of classical music, but even like the original score for the anime is pretty good. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to sell this without spoiling it, so I think I'll just stop there.
it's an adaptation from a manga, isn't it?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Yes, I'm looking at it now, and yes, it started in April 2011, and it just finished in February of this year. So the manga finished in February, and the anime finished in March. So did it have an ending? Did it have a real ending?
Oh, yeah. Definitely had a real ending.
Oh, cool.
I can see how they might have progressed from there if they wanted to continue the story, but yeah, it ended at a very solid point. I had no idea there would even be more. I think it ended very well.
I'm looking at the production crew, and yeah, it's got an interesting sort of pedigree. The director hadn't really done anything that I've seen and liked besides he did storyboards for Kokoro Connect.
I don't even know what that is.
I liked Kokoro Connect. Did anyone ever see that?
Is that the one with
Body Switch comedy drama?
Oh, no. I'm thinking of someone else. I haven't seen it. Oh, that's... I've heard it was quite good, though.
It is. It's surprisingly good, because... actually, that's a little bit of an overlap on mine, although I won't launch too far into it. It's that, like, I saw Golden Time, and that did a memory loss surprisingly better than you'd expect, although still not great. And Kokoro Connect does like Body Switch and mind reading. There's this alien who just like jobs in these people's lives and like gives this group of five friends these special powers and just watches them shit all over each other's lives. And it's actually like fairly well considered in terms of like if you did switch bodies with like the boy that you had a crush on, like how would you react? And not in the typical anime way of like, oh, boobs and stuff, but actually like, you know, like how that fucks up your relationships to have lived in someone's body for a week and then switched back. And I don't know, that's pretty good. And similarly, Golden Time did a pretty good job of playing an amnesiac. The main problem was that there was a physical representation in Golden Time of the amnesiac memories, and that's terrible. I don't care if that's a spoiler.
I'm going to go back to Your Lie in April real quick. Just real quick. Sorry. I thought of something to say.
No, please.
It's definitely like, okay, so it's a very cliche story, but it's like, it's a very well-told cliche story. You know, like a lot of times you get these sort of stories that are like, oh, I see exactly what's going to happen. This one was sort of like that for me, but I didn't care. And that, I think for me, that's a sign of a good story in general. It's just when I know what's going to happen and it doesn't matter because I'm so enthralled by the entire thing that I just want to watch it through to the end, even though I know what the end's probably going to be. And in this case, I mean, like, you know, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I knew.
Have you watched Nodomi Cantilibra?
Yes, I have.
Does it compare well to that, or...?
It's a different kind of... Like, obviously they both very heavily, like, have to do with music, but it's a very different story.
Okay.
Like, Nodomi Cantilibra is more about, like, just this guy coming out of a shell, and, you know, they kind of fall in love, I think, by the end. But this is a lot more about the lies you tell each other and the lies you tell yourself and trying to see the truth within those lies, and yeah.
Sounds a lot darker than it's presented.
Sounds good.
Okay, so that's the end. That's all I have to say.
You know, you're talking about physical representations of amnesia. Isn't that similar to the princess girl in the Maggie Brilliant Park? That was kind of a weird ending.
Yeah, I mean... It's odd because I think every culture like has like an idea of what the experience of amnesia is like, and I think that largely the one I see most commonly in Japanese live action and anime drama is dumb and weird. I don't mean to be that pejorative. Obviously, I just did. But like
in Golden Time, it was dumb. Like just to be clear, it was really dumb.
It was terrible. It had this guy like at first I kind of liked it because it was like oh. There's this guy's, he used to be the shitty person. He got amnesia and became like a lot nicer of a person. And generally like more mature but he's got his like old memories of being like a shitty high school kid, like haunting him.
Yeah.
But then it becomes clear that they're literally haunting him. And spoiler, just like take off your headphones for 5 seconds. Later in the series, the ghost of his old memories tries to kill him. And that's just terrible. And like John, I know you stopped watching it because of this stuff, and I was tempted, but overall it's only really insufferable because the show itself is so good. Golden Time itself is like a better, more mature version of Toradora, which is the same author, same studio, doing that sort of thing. So like it just makes the ghost shit stand out because it's so such at odds with like this really. Like cute thing of like a girl who's grown up all her life thinking she's going to marry this one guy and then she goes to college and the guy's like, haha, it's been cute that you thought we were going to get married when we grew up, but I don't want to marry you and I've never wanted to marry you. We were kids. And watching like how she develops from that point, it's amazing. And it's the main problem is just that the guy she falls for like has a shitty ghost haunting him.
Damn shitty ghost.
Yeah. So like I was enjoying it pretty well up until the point where the ghost shows up. And then I was like, I'm done for the night. I'll just come back tomorrow. And then I never came back. And I felt pretty happy about that decision.
Have you seen Shukan Friends? 1 Week Friends?
No.
Okay.
No, I haven't.
Because that is a story. That is a story about a girl who gets amnesia after a week and just forgets everything that's happened apart from like learning.
Just over and over?
Yeah, just over and over and over again. And it's kind of just about a guy.
Is that like
Oh, so it's like 50 First Dates.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. That's the one I was trying to remember.
I guess. I haven't seen that. I can't even tell you whether the Shukan Friends was good. We watched like 4 episodes and then stopped for no reason. That's just what I wanted to mention. Just wanted to bring that up, I guess.
I was going to say that Ben bringing, like, talking about how the ghost is, like, actually shitty and he doesn't, like, he doesn't actually successfully do anything. That sort of makes me feel a little bit better about his existence because the reason I stopped is because I was really worried that eventually they were just going to converge into one person and he was going to be really conflicted and just, like, I didn't want to deal with it. It's just...
Oh, there's some of that, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, then.
The thing is, it's just, like, it's... And this is something we've actually been talking about a lot, like, off and on with our anime conversations, is your ability to, like, compartmentalize the terrible or, like, gross exploitational stuff in anime and just enjoy the stuff that exists apart from that. And so the fact that there's a subplot where he lost all his memories up until a certain point when he had this accident. And he's afraid that when he gets his memories back, his self since the accident is going to be destroyed. And so that's a lot of the angst, is just him being like, oh, if I lose all these memories that I've had, then all my actions are meaningless and blah, 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 blah. I don't know. So like, that's terrible, but that's maybe like 30% of the anime. And so if the fact that the other 70% is amazing is enough for you to make it through, that's one thing, but I wouldn't blame anybody. I didn't blame you for quitting because it's just like it's great, but there's so much anime out there, yeah. And like a 70% amazing anime is not enough sometimes, and I can't fault anyone for that.
I mean, you know, I could be watching better things with my time anyway. I'm saying I could watch better. I could watch Golden Time. That'd be better than some of the stuff I am watching, like Space Cobra. I don't know if does anybody here know what Space Cobra is?
I think I do.
I'm googling it right now.
It's basically like Conan the Barbarian in space, the anime. It's very like all of the women are half naked. It's you know, like it's got a very cheesy feel to it in terms of like the designs of aliens and whatnot, but. And it also, like, all of the women, all of them are invariably half naked, all of them. Most of them, in fact, are significantly more than half naked. Like, they're wearing bikinis while going on an archaeological dig. So, the only reason I brought that is because you were talking about compartmentalizing terrible things to enjoy the good things. Space Cobra is very, very lowbrow, but I enjoy the stuff that isn't that, and it's annoying. Trying to deal with that while I'm actively watching this and enjoying it and also being disgusted at myself the entire time. So yeah. There you go.
I mean, yeah, we've all been there,
yeah.
Dear readers, dear listeners, that like, I mean, I don't know.
I mean, like,
sometimes you draw
like
points.
The one show that I found the best last season, which I guess
Prison
is a
School?
Segue onto my thing. No, well, that is good. But it wasn't that.
Okay.
It was Food Wars or Shokugeki no Soma, which I know is something that Duncan is also watching.
Mm-hmm.
But I know he hasn't gotten as far as me.
I've only watched the first episode, and I was very tempted to drop it because of the first episode being almost entirely about the evil ladies bouncing boobs. And
yeah. No, I and that's why it's really hard to sell it because. That is quite a major part of it in a way. Like the artist, I was reviewing this, or my girlfriend kind of told me this, but apparently there's 3 people on the manga. There's an artist who is a famous doujinshi artist, a writer who writes the story, and then there's a third person who's a food researcher who researches the food. Apparently some of the foods has already got recipes to them, like some of the insane shit that like some of the insane food has got recipes that in that first episode, the rice that he makes, the woman with the god tongue, I believe that is an actual recipe that you can make. So that'll be fun.
The one with the bacon wrapped potatoes or whatever? Or
No. The one which is like a rice bowl. And the egg is melted. The thing, like, there's a thing, a roux that melts onto the egg, and then it's.
I don't think that's the first episode, but First episode had fried rice, and then he made bacon wrapped potatoes. So
yeah, it was fuck. That might have been the second episode.
And then he also had a peanut butter grilled squid.
Yeah.
which included a reaction that, well, tentacles.
Yeah, tentacles. I mean, that's the problem. Like, there is a lot of sort of weird nudity, but I mean, it's an equal hand. The girls and the guys get naked whenever they eat food.
See, that's what people say, but it wasn't any, like, the guys were played up for laughs in the first episode, whereas,
yep.
Like, literally, yeah. There were like five separate close ups on the evil lady's bouncing breasts, and it was.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
There's an older student in. Who comes into it a couple of episodes in, who basically walks around in nothing but a half apron all the time. That's a male, not a female. And
okay, so that's good.
On Idle Thumbs, they were talking about how in Metal Gear Solid, the camera lingers on one of the characters' buttocks before panning up. It's done that to him several times now.
Yeah.
The camera sort of starts lower below his apron and just pans up from his ass.
Oh, really? Okay. That's unique, because that's something I've been noticing more and more with anime, is the way the camera just, like, it likes to pan up women's bodies, but it almost never does it for male bodies. Like,
I think it must be deliberate, because...
In a lot of cases, yeah, for sure. But yeah. I bet it's also, like, to just be, like, point out, like, yeah, men are sexy, too. Get over it.
But also, yeah, I mean, he's not a bad looking guy as well, it should just be said. He's not ugly by any means.
Yeah, so he's not like, because one of the dudes was like a really fat guy, and he was like tied up in a rope, and it was like clearly just meant to be played for laughs.
Now, this guy could easily be a female romance novel protagonist.
Shoujo.
Yeah, shoujo that's boyfriend. The word I was searching for and couldn't remember.
Alright, that's cool.
Yeah, but, like, also, just in general, like, the series does a really fucking good job of turning everybody, like, it makes a really good job of making everyone seem unique, and then also makes everyone not useless. Like, the school that they go into in, like, the third episode, so this plot is that his dad is an amazing chef. He himself is also an amazing chef, and he tries to compete with his dad, he never wins. His dad then tells him that he's going to go and send him to this really prestigious school of chefs, where he'll learn to be a great chef and be able to take on the family business.
And all that stuff appeals to me, because I like shonen and I like food.
Yeah, and then it's just sort of like his trials and tribulations in school. And the big thing in this school is that there are these things called food wars. I can't remember. They're called shokugekis, hence the title. What they are is they're essentially like a sort of Iron Chef food clash, where one person is fighting another person, and whoever wins gets to win a reward depending on their own set agreement as to what the winning would be. So, that sounded really fucking long for something that probably could have explained very easily.
It's like... It's like Kaigi meets the British Bake Off.
Yeah. So the first one is he's meet, like, someone's trying to close down one of the school clubs, and he's trying to protect it. And her win condition is if she wins, the club goes down. Soma's win condition is that if he wins, she has to join the club. And that's it. And, you know, like, it does some, like, really sweet, it does some really sweet stuff with characters. Like, a lot of the some characters who I pigeonholed as being like, oh, she's going to be the useless shonen trope A, then sort of turns around quite well. And I don't know if Duncan's got to that bit, or if you know who I'm talking about.
I assume we're talking about the dark-haired girl. I'm on episode 17, so I'm like two-thirds through.
Right, yeah.
Season run.
Yeah, so you've gotten past the trip. Training ground trip, right?
Yes, the trip. Yeah.
You'd know who the person I'm talking about is. And I thought that was really
Megumi.
Nice. Megumi, yeah. To not give away any spoilers, but like they and then you get like you get some other stuff too with the other characters, and it's really good. It does a really good job of actually caring about the characters and making you starving because the food looks fucking delicious.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It's a bit weird for me as a vegetarian, because there's a lot of meat.
Yeah, that must have been a really hard sell. because it's all meat. There's no, like, there's a couple of vegetarian dishes, but most of it's just meat.
It's like, if I go to Japan, it's evident from this, if I ever go to Japan, I'm completely and utterly screwed in terms of my food intake.
No, there's a lot of, there's definitely a lot of vegetarian food in Japan. I don't think Food Wars is representative of typical Japanese cuisine.
Food in Japan.
But I think, and don't quote me on this, but I think their terms of vegetarianism is different from ours. They probably will just take the meat out, and then even if it's been cooking in, like,
that's true. Pig,
like, I don't quote me on this, and I don't want anyone to hate me to say that. But I think that might be the case. But you should be fine. Like, if they have like a curry and you ask for the vegetarian curry, but they only have a beef curry and a vegetarian curry, they probably only have one curry, but then they'll just take the beef out and serve you the curry sans beef. So it's still got, like, beef in it, like in the roux and stuff, but you wouldn't know about that, if that makes sense. But I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
Don't quote me on that.
Nope. I'm quoting you.
The thing about Food Wars is that I think there's a word I've seen in some criticism recently about media in general, which is that it has problematic elements. Some of the designs for the women are distinctly not good in some ways. There's a sort of American girl who is just blonde and wearing a bikini. Yeah. Blonde and wears a bikini basically all the time, and that's sort of
that's very typical of, like, American girls that come over to Japan. They're just always like, I don't give a fuck, I'm not gonna wear anything. It's in Kuroko's Basketball too.
Tanned blonde girl who doesn't wear much.
Yep, she's blonde and she has large breasts and she wears, like, nothing ever.
She's not tanned. She's not tanned. Isn't she Japanese? Isn't she half Japanese, half American? Or am I?
That's always the get out of jail clause.
Yeah,
I can't remember, but even those shortcomings of, like, a bit too much TNA and stuff, I still really enjoyed Shokugeki no Soma. Even though my voice is now going, I think it's really, really good. And I think everyone should watch it. Yes, the end.
I intend to give it a few more episodes because, everyone's, like, telling me it gets way better after the first episode, so...
Yeah.
You know, it's on my list, along with a million other things.
Well, wonderful. Anyone else have any notable things that they've watched over the past month or so?
I can talk about how I've gone through 3 seasons of working.
Okay, I can go back. I can come back to working, so hit me.
Or how do we pronounce it? It's Western Town.
Wagnaria?
Is it Wagnaria?
Wagnaria.
Yeah. I started pronouncing it to myself sort of Wagnaria. So
I don't think it's a Gotterdammung themed family restaurant, no.
It would be good if it was, though.
If only.
But I think you talked about it a couple of episodes back, and you said that its big failing was that for most of the first 2 seasons, there's absolutely no development in the characters at all. They're basically just circling in this plot stasis for 2 series. And then the 3rd one, this actually seems to be some development, sort of cautiously. Although they do seem to sort of decide to back out of going anywhere really with it in the last couple of episodes and are now throwing out a completely weird OVA.
Oh, I didn't want you to ruin that. I wanted him to find that out himself.
It's okay. I knew there was going to be something. Like, the thing with working, what really bugged me is just that you have these intricately crafted love triangles, and then you just never resolve them, and it's like some bizarre form of anime torture of just being like, who will they choose? No one, ever.
How far are you into the 3rd season, then?
I'm 2 episodes from the end. I was going to finish it out to make Andy happy. But then my weekend took over. So I just watched a bunch of Deadwood with my girlfriend again, which I thought about bringing up when you guys were talking about Lies Agreed Upon and Your Lie in April. But no, so I'm a little bit from the end. But I know, like, the whole... And this is something that I really have a... If anyone else has thoughts, I would appreciate some help. We can work it out on air. Is that anime that are based on 4Koma have a really, really odd pacing to them? Because, like, 4-panel comics have this sort of, like, cycle where it's a very fast, like, setup resolution. You can do these sort of, like, circular hops forward as different details are developed throughout the different like small joke setups. But when we convert this to anime, where yeah, the cycle of joke is about like a complete setup and execution every 2.5 minutes, so you can have roughly 10 jokes and 10 full like cycles like that an episode, it does have this sort of odd like lurching forward pace that never seems to quite get anywhere. And like thinking of Working, Servant Service, K-On!, those are the major ones I think of that are really successful
for Azumanga Daioh.
Azumanga Daioh, yeah.
In terms of Working, I think that structure works with Working because it's how working in a workplace actually feels, because you're never standing around with someone for 10 minutes. You're sort of moving from place to place and you'll bump into someone, an interaction will happen, then you'll move away, 10 minutes later, another interaction. And so it actually has this weird fit with how actually working is. It's these little moment, another moment, and they're not necessarily connected even in sort of a real working environment, and so it actually works better than you'd expect it to. Or at least that's how I feel about it.
So you're saying that the strength of working is almost like a sort of like diffuse verisimilitude in it, that like it feels authentic to a working environment.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, like, and it's also interesting because like a lot of the jokes involve two people having an interaction and the third person ducking in and doing something. And that also that actually I had thought does feel a lot like working, where feels a lot like the act of working, not the anime working.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so happy that it's turning out to be a kind of show I can recommend. But it is very interesting that like the arcs and the love triangles that are getting resolved are the ones I enjoy more, and the ones that aren't getting resolved are the ones that I find frustrating. Like I could really care less about Takanashi.
I like Sato, and I like their relationship.
No,
I liked it how it got resolved as well. I thought it was quite nice.
Yes, no, I like that. I like I liked the owner and his lost wife. I like Yamada and her family. I do not care about Inami, and that's the one that at least the author of the original source material seems to think is like the bang pow moneymaker, and I'm not invested at all into the fact that like apparently that's what they're just going to drag out forever.
Oh, I like it. I like that because it's a change, just because it was kind of set up from the beginning that he'd be like attracted to Popura because she's small and cute. And
yes.
Then I like the change that he's had to deal with himself, of the thing that he in his own head thinks he shouldn't like, he is falling for.
I guess I do
like that a lot.
I do definitely think though, like what John had said about how your line April has this problem where young kids act like implausibly mature. I think a lot of working, especially with Inami and Takanashi, is that like these people are implausibly dense. just to the point that like I want to like yell at my screen like a terrible moviegoer.
Isn't that technically the mark of a good romantic comedy? I mean, I always remember one of my favorite comedy series was Frasier, and I remember the Miles and Daphne thing, which went on for like 5 seasons and made me want to yell at the thing every time. And the show only really fell apart when that actually got consummated, so perhaps them being hopeless is a good thing.
I mean, I'm going to be genuinely terrible, especially as someone who's never made a major piece of fiction. But like, if there's nothing to your characters after you resolve the romantic tension, then maybe you need new characters. And especially in Working, where like I'll just go around quickly in a circle. Sorry, John, you can't play. Who's the worst character on Working? Let's just do it that way. Who's the one that you just delete them and they don't exist anymore and the show's the same or better for it?
Popura.
I actually like all of them. I don't think there's a single character I hate, so
not
that
hate,
one.
But like least essential, if you can't do hate.
The one that only appears like once, and then when she speaks, you know it's the end of the season. With the curly hair and the glasses.
Ah, the normal girl.
You're fired from the podcast.
Yeah.
No, I agree with Duncan. Like, Papara doesn't need to be there. Like, she exists as an excuse for Takanashi to get the job. And after that, she is like this weird, denser. She especially is incredibly dense, even without having a romantic relationship to justify it. But I think that there is just the ability of like the character ensemble to kind of support the weaknesses in the various characters so that you don't notice them. You can like them all because they all serve a function in this kind of organism that is a workplace environment. But man, some of them I like more than others. When I pick up on an episode like, oh, this is going to be a Soma and Sato heavy episode, I'm happy. And when it's going to be that Papara has a toothache and isn't telling anybody, I open a window of solitaire on my desktop while I'm watching it.
I'm sure I remember you saying your sort of on the forums, you saying your favorite was in fact Yamada.
I love Yamada. I would watch a whole show that's just her. Yes, that's correct.
Her resolution is amazing. I really liked her story.
Well, like the great thing about that is, again, like we resolve it and she like is reunited with her family and whatever, and she stays in the show and can like it. Like it's a fundamental change for her condition, but it doesn't change her role on the show because she's such an essential. I mean, and that's kind of the thing is when you first start watching Working, the work like everyone like does their jobs and is good at stuff. And so Yamada fills this important role of the person who does not deserve to have her job, and if the world operated properly, she'd be fired. And I enjoy that even beyond the really, like, the odd voice performance of her voice actress and the weird way that she, like, they animate her, like, walking and moving and how she ducks into scenes and stuff. Like, I just enjoy from the basic, like, components of her performance up to the role she serves in the operation of the show. Like, I've written two blog posts on my anime criticism blog about Yamada because I think like she's the best thing in Working and also just the fact that like everyone else in Working is so concerned with romance and like yeah. I think there's one subplot where Yamada like is thinking about like if a guy is a crush on her, but overall she wants a family and she wants friends and she wants to be liked, and those are kind of presented as like more difficult to get than a boyfriend or girlfriend. It's just like someone who genuinely likes you, especially when you're annoying and stupid like Yamada is. Sorry, I just went off on Yamada. I can't recall if I went off on her on the last episode too, but if I did, I'm sorry, readers.
You mentioned her briefly. I don't remember you going off on one.
Readers, you should be apologizing to me. That would seem.
I can see you picking your nails. About. They're going to be very clean by the end of this episode.
No, playing with some pins.
But no, so I guess the curtain's gone on the ending of Working and that it's not really going to be an ending and you're going to be a bit annoyed, but you're also probably never going to see the actual ending because it will never be officially come out over here. We'll probably have to wait for some fans up to do it.
I mean, who knows? There are some situations where if a review is, if a license is suitably delayed, they'll pick up the OVA and pack it on the DVD. But if it's going to take a year or something, then yeah, probably not.
It's already being streamed, then it's probably not going to take that long, right? Because they already have the license. I mean, I don't know how it works, I guess.
But it's like an hour special. Yeah. It is going to be televised. I don't know whether that changes anything. But
from what I understand, the OVA is of almost zero connection to the actual series. And as far as I'm aware, they have confirmed that there's going to be another 13 episodes of the conventional series. So,
really?
Fingers crossed for resolution? Well, another series.
So you're saying this is a very long series?
Yeah. But, well,
I mean, it's not that long because because they're only a half core, so it's just 13 episodes.
I thought it was at 30 episodes right now.
It's had three seasons.
Yeah, and then didn't he just say 30 more, or did he just say 13 more, and I'm just
13 more.
Okay, I'm just an idiot. Ignore me.
They're doing another, okay.
I cannot find any evidence that there'll be a fourth season of Working.
Perhaps I misread.
But there is going to be a bundled announcement with the special episode, and who knows what that is.
Probably be a fourth season.
It'd be nice to go back to the show now that like everyone's like issues are resolved and just like, oh, it's literally just a workplace drama.
I wonder if that's why it ended, not because like all the relationships got resolved, but they did that and then that sort of inherently became boring and she couldn't write anything for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, she also has Servant Service, which is the same fucking show, but without Yamada, so not as good.
The announcement is that the two companies are going to have an in-world merge, and you're going to see all the staff from Ragnaria move to the Servant X Service offices and start working there.
They pointed out that the two school-age girls, Yamada and the annoying tsundere one, who's the little sister in Servant Service, have the same school uniform, so they technically probably go to school together. So there is a metaverse. There's a Saint Elsewhere of anime going on.
Amazing.
Here.
What? Okay. Well, whatever.
Anyway, let's move on to something that doesn't bore the hell out of John.
No, I'm fine. I'm fine. No,
that's
fine. Don't worry about me.
One thing, the other good foreshot, like the thing I usually wanted to mention about foreshots is I think like a lot of the resolutions that happen, they're not done as foreshots. I think there's generally like a one or two to four page spread maybe, or an actual storyboarded comic. That sounds really rude, but I hope you understand what I mean. Like,
yeah,
where they actually have the big resolution, and that's quite obvious when you're watching it that it feels like a continuous thing instead of the stopping, starting, like the number of segs between, like the number of cutaways that are in like the working anime is quite a lot, and then you'll get like the sweet scene, the romance scene, the love scene, like that will feels like a longer thing. So it's either that it's directed that way or that they get a couple more pages to actually as an actual comic format instead of the normal four shot, which I don't know.
No, it's interesting. It's kind of a hybrid format, because I mean, working is quite funny, but it also does have like legitimate character arcs, and for a lot of that to be carried out through the humor, but then also to switch over to a different style of panel layouts it's interesting. Yeah,
like I think another four shot that was this season is Himoto Maru-chan, which I won't talk about because I mentioned it last episode, but that ended doing nothing, and I was fine with that because it was funny. Like, I don't mind four shots because it's amusing, and as long as it makes me laugh, I think that's all I want. That's all the artist wants to get out of it, and that's all that I want to get out of it, is that it's funny. That is another thing maybe that you should watch. You should watch Maru-chan because it's funny.
I don't even know if I've seen anything that are based on four commas. Is Tenari no Seki-kun one of them? Or is that original?
No, that's original. I don't know. Lucky Star? If you've seen Lucky Star,
nope.
Lucky Star's a four shot.
Not seen it. I don't think I have seen any, to be honest. Anyway.
No, Tenari no Seki-kun's a four coma.
There we go.
Oh, is it?
I've seen one. Hooray.
I'm thinking of something different.
I have experienced a thing.
Oh, no. Yes. Sorry. I was thinking of Tenari no Kaibutsu-kun, which is a completely different.
Another neighbor.
Yeah.
Tenari means neighbor, readers. Translator's note, Tenari means neighbor.
Yeah.
All according to Keikaku.
Cancel the podcast. Podcast is over.
Talking about translator's notes, you're talking about the best ones on the chat. I just wanted to bring this one up. There's one where it was like, where it's like, it said, hey, 3-9. And then the guy goes, I don't really understand, like, the translation at the top. He goes, I don't really understand what he was saying here, but it was something 3-9. So I assume it's to do with Facebook, like, numbers or an in joke or something. And then, like, 3 in Japanese is san. And 9 is Q, so he's saying thank you, thank you, but he couldn't work it out. Oh, amazing.
Jesus.
That's great. Today, I watched an episode of Dragon Ball Super where the translator's note was, Baka means stupid.
You can't see readers, but I'm facepalming, so. Oh, Jesus. Yeah, languages are hard.
Not
they
this,
mean
but he
things.
Said what it was, though. Like, when you say exactly what the word is, you can just replace the word with the other word, and it's fine.
That reminds me of the... Oh, go ahead. We're going to just tell some stories, I guess. Feel free to join in, anybody.
The one I was thinking of is Shinsengumi subs for Gintama. There was one Akagi ripoff that Gintama did, and it was Mahjong-based. And at the end of the series, at the end of the episode, they had about 2 minutes just explaining the rules of Mahjong. It was amazing.
Those are cool, though. I like those kind of things.
I mean, yeah, that's how a couple of old groups, now defunct, roll.
Yeah.
But
yeah, and there was also the infamous Clan Ad one about the chess. If you remember that episode?
I do not. I'm afraid. Enlighten us.
I don't know when this was, because I've only seen the screens, and they're really funny. But so there's a move. There's one bit in Clan Ad. Not Clan Ad, fuck. Code Geass. Where he's
how do you mix those two anime up? No, we're telling a different story now.
Wait, what was the other one?
Clannad or Code Geass?
Oh, Jesus, okay.
It began with a C. It began with a C.
Those two seem somewhat different.
Cute anime about falling in love, or weird ass mind control.
Which is getting a third season, by the way. I don't understand.
Does anyone watch Code Geass? I mean,
I've
obviously
watched
you do.
The first episode like 4 times, and the first episode of the second season once. The first episode of the second season has the main girl in a bunny suit for no other reason than to put her in a bunny suit. Yeah.
all right.
She was some hostess at a club.
All right.
But yeah,
all right.
No. Have you seen the?
We're getting a little rambly. Maybe we should rein it in here.
Have you seen the Code Geass one, now that I'm talking about? Now I've got the right anime. Have you seen that one?
No. No, I haven't.
So the main guy with the eye is, like, I think it's the main guy. I don't know. They're playing chess, and some guy, like, it's obviously one of those things where the animators don't really care about chess. They just want to make it look like he's doing a move to make him look cool.
Uh-huh.
So the idea is that he's really fucking amazing at chess. So he does, like, one move and then walks off, and he's like, checkmate, motherfucker. And then he, you know, drops mic and runs. And then, but the move he makes doesn't make any sense in terms of chess, and it isn't a checkmate. So they have, like, this whole annotation war about why his move made sense and how it could have caused a checkmate. And it's literally, like, 2 pages of of translation note, which is amusing.
Holy shit. Okay.
I just posted it in the chat. It's pretty great. It's basically a screenshot of a guy's hand on a chess piece, and it's covered with roughly around 1,200 words in four nested translator notes. Oh, jeez. Okay. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some serious anime. Rurouni Kenshin, Trust and Betrayal. I'm sorry, everybody.
I'm dying.
Okay, let's go. You've driven yourself to you're just laughing at your own joke for the past 5 minutes.
It keeps going.
It does. It's amazing. So is. Right, well, I just wanted to know that One Piece is the best thing that, like, I thought it would be and that I knew it would be.
One Punch Man, you mean? Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
One Punch Man.
Yeah, it's still funny, and it's still, like, and it, like, you know how the manga panels are, like, super detailed sometimes, and there's just, like, it's almost like frames of an animation, with the way they play out? Well, that's what they've basically taken that amount of detail and put it into an anime. And the first
episode
is amazing.
Does it start
from
the beginning? Because I imagine it can be, as, like,
yeah, it starts, like, in the beginning.
Because I can imagine that sort of anime, it can
jump around a lot.
Like, or, the first episode, like, yeah, it might jump around a little bit. Cause...
Okay, so the way it starts is it shows him, like, I don't remember if it's when he's buying something or something. Like, he gets attacked and he just, like, oh, it's my turn, I guess I'll just go fight this guy. And then he goes and beats him one punch, and then it goes back in time to where, when he still had hair, and then he's fighting that crab dude. Just, I think the manga does, I think the manga does the same thing. And then, you know.
The crab dude comes later, I think.
Yeah, but
I think for a very long time he's just very melancholy.
Maybe I don't remember exactly how it went down, but yeah, it does start in the present and then go back in time and then come back to the present, and then it just kind of shows him beating a few dudes up. And then remember when he had that dream about fighting all of those, like, that big massive army of subterraneans, and he was like really sad when he woke up because it wasn't real. that happens.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good.
Oh, amazing. So, like, my favorite thing is just, like, his melancholy at the end of it is just my favorite thing. I absolutely love, like, him as, like, is he good? Like, because he's also, talking about, like, new talent, the voice for Saitama, I believe, is a new VA. When I was looking at it,
I really don't know.
He didn't seem to be in much.
He's a good voice, though. It works for him. I really like
it. Yeah, that's the thing. It does work. It really does.
The OP is also really great. Yeah, it's really good. I enjoyed it a lot. I'm looking forward to it next week.
Soon as this ends, I'm going to watch it because I'm so bearing forward.
I'm just, the only thing I'm worried about is that they like blew all of their budget on this first episode, and the next episode's going to be a severe drop in quality.
But the manga was like, the manga is interesting because it started as a web manga.
Yeah.
And then became really popular. And then, so I think it might have gotten published, but I don't think it did. I think it's still a web manga.
Well, like the original manga written by One is still being produced. And then there's this manga that's running alongside it now that's trying to catch up, but it's much more detailed and much better art. And then this anime is based on, obviously, the newer manga.
Oh, no, the so, that yeah, there's One who does the storyboards, but he releases the storyboards separate, and then he gives the storyboards to the artist, who does Eye Shield 21, and then that gets produced in Shonen Weekly Jump, Shonen Huge Jump, whatever.
I did not know he did Eye Shield 21. I liked Eye Shield 21. I used to, anyway.
Yeah, it's the same artist. But yeah, so that is why there's two versions of it.
Okay, I didn't know that. I thought that the original was just, like, the guy doing it for fun, and then it got picked up, and somebody, like, a real artist did it.
No, the original, I mean, One has done some other ones as well, which are quite good. But yeah, he's not the best artist, and that's how that came about. But I think they're both online, I think. I believe so. That's why, like, because there's that one where, you know when he goes into the enemy spaceship? This is big spoilers for the anime.
You know when he goes
into the enemy spaceship? And they have that picture of him in a maze. And he's been, and then it sort of zooms in, and zooms in, and zooms in. It's insane, like, how detailed this maze is.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember that bit? That was something the artist has been working on for something like 5 years with his son. And then he just sort of put it in. And it, like, so, I mean, that, the fucking artist is amazing. And it really shows through, especially on like the ones which are like a flick book.
They're made
when he's like punching stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Like, there's one where it's like, I think Genos and Saitama are doing some training, and it does like this big camera rotation around them as they're going in. It's so good. Like, it's literally good. Just frames of an animation in manga format.
Yeah, and there's another one where he's like fighting that ninja guy.
The
and
Sonic the ninja's Speed
jumping around him, and
there's the same thing.
Like,
camera
rotates.
Like, yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah. I'm so looking forward to the anime.
And welcome back. For the second half of our podcast, we're going to be talking about Rurouni Kenshin, Trust and Betrayal, also known as Samurai X, Trust and Betrayal, if you like.
Worst name.
Yeah, the ways that we used to change anime to appeal more to American audiences that are scared of words that don't look like English.
Which I have to say, it was more Samurai I for like most of the movie, and then at the very end he got his X.
it was Samurai Backslash, actually. Samurai hack slash. Okay.
That's a good joke. This was, oh man. Okay, sorry, go on.
This was a OVA in four parts done in 1999 that was re-edited into a single theatrical release in 2003 and called the Director's Cut, which is what I watched. It sounds like most of you guys watched the OVA.
Mm-hmm. I did, yeah.
I did.
It's directed by Furuhashi Kazuhiro, who was the director of the TV series, and actually almost all the production staff is from the TV series, which was, what, 95 episodes?
It was too long.
it was about 30 episodes too long, I will agree with that. As I was talking about before we came back, just a glance at the Wikipedia page tells us that it's one of the most well-regarded anime of all time, at least at the time. A lot of these people probably haven't gone back and watched it again, but we have. So does anyone have any opening comments, any strong reactions to Rurouni Kenshin, Trust and Betrayal?
Strong? No, I don't have anything strong to say about it at all.
Well, I never...
That's my biggest complaint.
I only know Rurouni Kenshin loosely. I've read like 3 volumes of the manga, and I didn't think it would be this sort of like miserable. I thought he was kind of like a happy-go-lucky guy. I didn't think he...
Yeah, in the series, he's definitely a lot more...
He is in the TV series, and yeah. That's actually like one of the few criticisms you can find online is people like, where is his trademark? Like, Oro? Which is he says, which he says when he's like surprised or confused. And where's his like weird kind of fucked up way of talking where he's like really, really weirdly uncomfortably polite to everybody. As an origin story, I think of some people who were really attached to the anime and manga found it off-putting. But I don't know. Kenshin's like happy-go-lucky stuff I found kind of grating in the TV series. Like if you don't like how Vash acts in Trigun, you're not going to like Rurouni Kenshin because Vash is serious as hell next to...
Yeah, that's true. See, I watched all of the Rurouni Kenshin material in quick succession. I watched the series, then this OVA, and then the other OVA or movie. I can't remember what it was. The one that's like a sequel to the series, whereas this is the prequel. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, I didn't... The first time I watched it, I liked Trust and Betrayal, but I was also, like you were talking about, disappointed that it wasn't the character that I liked. It's a lot more serious and darker. Oh, and
I wasn't
whatever,
disappointed. I was surprised and I enjoyed that. Like,
no, I was referring to the series. Comments.
Like, I don't know. I just thought it was interesting.
Anyway, and then I watched it this time, and I was hoping that I would like it more as a standalone thing, but as it turns out, I just wasn't interested at all. I was just kind of bored the whole time. Didn't enjoy it at all. I didn't hate it either. I was just kind of watching it. It was there.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, that's my opinion. I don't have a lot of strong thoughts about it. Sorry. Like, it was just kind of non-existent for me. I don't know.
Is this? Does anybody know? Is this like, without being an ass? Is this canon? Like, is this actually?
Yes. Yeah.
Whatever. I mean,
is it in the manga? Sure. Or is this?
Yes.
Yeah. It's like an manga. Interlude almost.
Yes, it's canon. It was based on like an interlude scene in the manga, going back to his history in the during the Bakumatsu. So it's 100% canon, and it's made by all the people who had made the TV series, and it's literally just a side story showing his origin, which is conveyed perfectly fine in the main anime. So it's almost unnecessary if you are perfectly happy with the Kenshin that you get in the TV series.
It's interesting that you mentioned the designs, because you have... Most of it is obviously a very different stylistically to the original Kenshin, but there's two characters. His mentor, who we see at the beginning of the four OVAs. I'm afraid I don't know his name, but the huge bloke with overdramatic hair. His character design...
Hiko Seijuro.
He looked kind of like a square with a head.
Indeed. He's basically, I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with Terry Pratchett's work, but he's got a character who's called Carrot because he's like shaped like a triangle. He just goes up to these huge shoulders, and this guy's exactly that same way. He just sort of starts and he just goes up to these huge shoulder pads. And then there's the little brother who we meet at the end, who still has this incredibly petulant Shohan face, which just looks completely out of place, is where you've got all these people who have very subtle emotions drawn on them, and then you have this kid sort of snarling at the camera.
Yeah.
Those two are obviously, spoilers, big characters within the wider arc of the series, and it was sort of strange that Kenshin himself was very different from his incarnation in the TV series, but these sort of other characters who were part of both narratives retained their original appearance. So that was sort of strange. It's like you obviously know who he is, but they had to keep their designs the same to remind you of who they were, is the only explanation was able to come up with. It it's like he's the motherfucking protagonist. The other question I was going to ask, I'd seen that in some places that this was called Recollections or Remembrance rather than Trust and Betrayal. Trust and Betrayal was the Western one?
Yes, I believe the reason they changed it from Recollection, which is the Japanese title, Suyoku-hen, to Trust and Betrayal, because they wanted to market it as a separate product that wouldn't require people buying the stacks and stacks of Kenshin DVDs, or at the time, I guess, also VHS cassettes, to feel that they could watch this, because it is quite a standalone work. I have read people criticizing it for having a couple of touches that aren't as meaningful, especially all of the flower imagery, which is extremely dense in the OVA. A lot of that is not as meaningful if you haven't watched the TV show, but they made the decision clearly to emphasize that it's its own complete story as opposed to a side story or a diversion from the plot of the main anime and or manga.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like the free-flowing sense of time in the OVA, especially how he's thinking about one thing and we cut back. Because in my memory, I had thought that we went strictly chronologically. He is rescued and he's trained and he meets with the head of the clan. Because I've only ever watched this as a single movie they have a few more scenes animated and cut in to make it all fit together as a single movie. And I thought of it as chronologically, and I was actually quite pleased that the chronology is so fluid and that they use this strategy of cutting back when contemporary events remind him of his training with his master, who also, Hiko Seijiro, his master, is an absurd character, but I actually kind of enjoyed him. I remembered him being like really into drinking sake and kind of ridiculous, but a lot of his statements I thought were actually quite restrained, and the sake thing only really came up as a leitmotif. So a couple of things, especially the character touches, definitely improved for me having rewatched it, almost 10 years later.
It's interesting you talking about how you didn't feel like it had a flow, you felt the flow was not in a straight line. You felt like it sort of meandered back and forth. Whereas to me, one of the things which sort of stood out was that after the first 15 minutes, it was basically a full cycle of a year. You went spring, summer, autumn, winter, and there was a very distinct... You were talking about the flower motifs and stuff as well, and that you had these distinct seasons, and the themes of those seasons were reflected in what was going on in the drama at the same time. And I felt like that was this chronological structure based around the sort of seasons actually felt very strong to me.
Oh, interesting.
Obviously, spring's sort of beginnings, summer is sort of like growth, autumn is sort of like harvest and sort of settling down for the winter, and then winter itself is death and sort of struggle. That's sort of how I read it, but...
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very apt, and I think that both of our observations are valid. If there's this like Kenshin's personal time, especially in the first half of the OVA series, that's he's kind of awash in his like formative experiences, and then his current work as an assassin. But at the same time, yes, there is a certain cycle to his life that the seasons do signpost very very easily.
Something which I completely forget the significance of, and which you guys might be able to fill in for me, is why is White Plum considered sort of a scandalous thing to be associated? Does that have traditional associations with prostitution or something?
I didn't get that impression. I thought it was just because it was out of season that it would be, had such an impact on people.
So it was because it was unnatural, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, at that time it was out of season. And also, I think the other impression was that him as a trained assassin killer, he knows the smell of a flower. Is a very sort of a very strange thing, and him as a character has not expressed any knowledge or information about anything apart from really killing and doing his job. And then for him to go off on like one about, oh, this smells like a flower. Like there were two parts where that was referenced, right? I'm not
wrong. Yeah, there was like the
Kenshin, and then his handler. The Shinsengumi's. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like his handler referenced it, and then his boss, his patron sort of mentioned it as well when they were at the inn. The reason I was wondering if it had like these associations with it is because the scene at the inn when he sort of takes offense to his patron commenting about it, and I wondered if it had like weird some sort of association.
My impression was just that he didn't want to come off as anything other than an emotionless killing robot. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I got.
I didn't get anything deep out of like the white plum flower. I think it was just out of season, and that's why people made remarks about it. And then when he accidentally made a remark about it, it sort of turned into a thing that he didn't want it to turn into, and blah, blah, blah.
It's worth pointing out that White Plum blooms in the winter, and it's especially a lot of the medieval and early modern Japanese poetry tradition likes White Plum because there's an obsession with white on white as a really powerful imagery. And so this idea of a white flower blooming among snow has like this really like refinement and purity. And also, according to this, to a website I checked, it also is supposed to mean past love and a protective charm against evil. So yeah.
No, well, in that case, it obviously does.
Okay, well, there you go. So that is some deep imagery.
Yeah.
No, I don't doubt from the very consistency which they show the different flowers, and then ultimately the last flower you see is the imperial chrysanthemum on a flag, that there is this like idea of the different flowers, the one held by the what's his name,
the dead fiance,
Kiyosato, the murdered young man who was supposed to be Tomoe's husband, that like all these flowers, how they are consistently associated with characters and moments and contexts, that there's probably a lot of powerful imagery there, that not having like a lot of the same array of cultural meanings for flowers is kind of lost on us. Just like for us, roses and lilies and daisies and sunflowers.
This could be something which I'm just assuming and is completely wrong, but there seems to be quite a few Japanese names which are based around flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if... Is her name any sort of play on that, or...?
Tomoe?
Tomoe, I couldn't say. Okay. I can look it up if you guys vamp, but...
It doesn't sound like a flower name.
I was just wondering if it was something I just missed, because I don't know the language at all. I mean, it's interesting that John said that his impression that it stood out because it was unnatural. It was sort of an interesting way of interpreting it, because one of the things I sort of...
Well, they do point it out at one point. They explicitly bring it up that it's out of season.
Yeah. It's like, there's this, I think, strong idea in it about this sort of the cyclical nature of existence, and that everything has a sort of beginning and an end to it. And there's a right place to be in that cycle, depending on where you are in the seasons or in your life or whatever. And that's one of the things which makes Kenshin stand out, is the fact that he's got this wound which doesn't close, and that's a very unnatural thing.
Mm-hmm.
The natural progress is that a wound is sort of cause and effect. You're given a wound and it heals and you have a scar, and that scar is a sort of reminder of what caused it. But he has this unhealing wound, which means he doesn't realise the cause yet. And until he realizes the cause, it can't heal.
I thought it was because it was like a grudge, wasn't it? That's what I got off it. Like the person who caused him that wound, it was a grudge wound, so that would never heal.
I know, but that information is given by the double agent who is looking to sabotage and betray Kenshin, though. So it's interesting. Interesting.
You could take it, I suppose, as Tomoe, like, once she learns that he's a real person and she, like, forgives him and falls in love with him, that's when the wound, you know, stops bleeding, and she does call it out at one point. And then once he learns about her again, starts bleeding. Once the double agent tells her that she was the spy, he gets, you know, emotionally wounded, and then it shows in his physical wound as well. I don't know.
I've just one thing on the names real quick. Sorry, I've just found out. I just Googled it.
Cool.
I don't know if this means anything, because this is on a Facebook post, but Tomoe means a whirl in water or falling snow. It could also mean...
Oh, so it is white on white.
Yeah.
So if Tomoe is like also snow reference,
a Japanese abstract shape that resembles a comet and a common design element in family crests and corporate logos.
I feel like that one's relevant.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And then her second name, Yukishiro. So Yuki means snow and Shiro means generation.
Yeah. So the name did have meaning. So it was white.
Shiro also means white.
Yeah.
So it's white on white, as you said. It's all there and we completely missed it.
Yeah. I mean, I read the, what are the name of the Hakunin issue? Ogura Hakunin issue. The 100 poems by 100 authors that's used for a Karuta. Those were assembled by a certain individual, I think in the 12th century. And he, like, one of his big obsessions was like white on white, especially flowers on snow, or linens on linen on snow, or like tears on linen, various things of like clear or white colors on top of each other. And that actually dictated a lot of the poetic tastes for hundreds of years. But it's interesting that it comes out so strongly here. And I wonder what the implications would have been to the average Japanese listener. Are they aware that like white on white is such a huge thing? Or is it just sort of sublimated into the culture, or is it the specific fictional interest of the writers? But it's definitely there. And I also wanted to, like, going back to Wounds, I think that one of the interesting things about this OVA is its interest in the infliction and appearance of wounds and on dead bodies, and how wounds and bodies look after they've been cut or harmed. Because in addition to Kenshin's, from the very beginning with the bandits attacking Kenshin's slave trader keepers, I guess, there are lingering shots on their bodies again and again. And I think a lot of the reviews, the contemporary reviews of this OVA focus on how the violence is very stark and unflinching. But I think that the desire of the director, it seems to me, is to show what a body looks like when it has a wound on it. And I think that goes hand in hand with just looking at Tomoe and how she interacts with the man who, as they say over and over, destroyed her happiness. Mm. is the term.
It's interesting you're talking about the sort of the weight that is behind both the swords and the bodies they're hitting, because mm-hmm. in that opening sequence there's a bit where he's, as a kid, he's picked up this huge sword and the women sort of pull him away, and the sword sort of just hangs there in the air for a second and just clatters down. And there were a couple of little bits of animation I really liked, and that was what the first one of them, because you get, sort of really get the sense of this, the sword as something which was too heavy for him. Like, mm-hmm. the moment that the support he's putting away is removed, it just sort of comes down. You can feel the weight in the animation. The other thing about that sequence, which I think was the first time you see it in there, but it happened a couple of other times, is that it went first person for a while, which is really not common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, no, I agree. There was obviously him seeing through the woman's hair, and later on we had a couple of occasions where it just cuts to someone's viewpoint, and we see him sort of looking from one side of a scene to another, and actually using that as a transition is really quite nice.
There was one really weird transition which had like him looking at a spinning top, and then the spinning top in like the third episode was so clearly just like a recorded video of a spinning top. It made me laugh.
Yeah, it's weird. They some things they were consistent about using those real world shots, but the spinning top, they seemed to not seem to be able to make their mind up whether they wanted to use a drawn version of it or this actual just rotoscoped film. Because they did that with the fire and the water as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I assumed that it was because they were saving the budget for the fourth episode.
Probably.
But yeah, the third episode had lots of very weird rotoscoping that just was quite garish. It was like, oh, that's a weird thing. It kind of pulled me out of the fiction somewhat.
Andy, it sounds like overall you weren't particularly impressed by this, no, by this OVA. Do you want to go into that?
So the first, if we're doing it episode by episode, the first episode I found quite confusing because I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't really understand any of the things, any of the people, and then it seemed like it was trying to tell something that evidently a lot of people either already knew, which I assume would be true because it felt like historical Japan, so that would be like historical Japanese knowledge, or some sort of like other stuff that was already revealed in the manga that fans would know. And then when it sort of stopped becoming about weird fighting and then it just became about Kenshin and Tomoe, then it sort of started becoming interesting. And then the last fight I really liked. Like, I really liked the last episode, like the imagery when it sort of cut it, when he was sort of being all dazed and blood loss, and he was cutting between like him, like the real world, and then him walking over, like walking on flowers and walking over the dead he killed. And like, I thought that was quite effective.
Mm.
And then also it was quite nice to see a main character have like really, like in the beginning, he has these really flashy fights where he just sort of, he runs, he does like a jump, a kick, a slash, and then he's killed like three people. And then at the end, that last
bit where he sort of he has been put off and he's like suffering injuries. He really is suffering those injuries. He feels like a lot of pain, and there's a lot of like slowness to it. And then even when he kills or dispatches the people, there wasn't any sort of beauty to it. It sort of felt just very much like he just knew that he had to do this thing to kill him. And I quite like that, if that makes sense.
That's interesting because obviously the mentor says this line to him, swordsmanship is at its essence a method of murder. That's all it is. And early on, the way we see the fights is as this all, as you're saying, almost like this ballet where he's sort of bouncing around, slashing cleanly, and those don't feel like murder. They just feel like this action sequence. But by the end, when he's just, it's just this brutal stabbing of a sword through someone's throat, just out of desperation almost, it actually fit. It's like his realization of that, yes, this, what I'm doing just is murder, is shown to us in the way that the fight's presented by the end.
Yeah, and then even when he didn't even look at the, he wasn't even looking at the guy, the first guy he killed on that walk up, he didn't even look at him. He just was like, oh yeah, there, he's dead. I knew he would be there. Like, that kind of showed that he was just using, like you said, using it as a tool. And I found that was quite effective. Like, I thought that was good. I didn't understand was why people started blowing up. I didn't get that. Like,
it was booby traps, I think. It was like,
he pulled out like a switch in the ground and it, I guess there was some gunpowder and it blew up. That's all it was. He knew he was dead, so he just tried to take him out with him.
Yeah,
but then
if I remember correctly from the manga, the idea is that they've already deadened his emotional state, and as he makes his way up, they're trying to deaden his physical sensations, his vision and his hearing. So they're trying to sort of blind him, and sort of you see his ears bleeding because of the explosions.
Yeah.
So it's the idea of sort of slowly taking away all these...
I thought that was
the
enemy's blood. Yeah. I didn't get that.
So it's the idea of slowly taking away his ability to read the fight. So when he gets to the end, he's just this bloody mess who can't think straight and can't even take in the scene properly.
Which has a tragic consequence, although probably not the one intended by the assassins from the shogunate.
But that scene didn't make sense as well, like how she got in front of him. I didn't quite get how she managed to get there when all of a sudden, like, after...
I think that's called the magic of storytelling.
It's called the dramatic moment.
And if you want to break it down, you can say that the shogunate bloke was so essentially almost monologuing. He was just there, happy he's going to have his moment of triumph, and Kenshin was just there, distraught. Everything took away from him. Literally nothing left of him apart from this ability to make these swings of his sword, and neither of them was aware of anything apart from themselves. Kenshin, just because everything had been took away from him, the other guy, just because he thought he was in complete control. So neither of them would have noticed her because they were just so wrapped up in it in their own particular ways.
Also, when he did the attack against the enemy, the final bad guy, the way that was shot and directed with, like, the blue streak after the sword was the same as when he was training with the post as well. I don't know if that would mean something, but I'm not intelligent enough to understand what it means. But, yeah, like, did anyone else notice that? Was that just me? If you guys know what I mean.
No, I mean, I know what you're talking about, and I do think that the intent there is, well, and this is something that's, the nice thing about watching the OVA after having watched the series, because I first watched the OVA separately and then back around 2003 when it came out, and then I watched the TV series on my own about 3 years ago, and was mildly enjoyed it, but wasn't really that impressed. And now watching this again is like a very like subtle theme throughout the TV series. It's just that like all swordsmanship can do is kill. And if you have an ideology that you believe in, there's only so much you can do to convey it with violence, because the ultimate expression of your swordsmanship is to kill somebody, not to convince them. And I think that that's even more present in the OVA, where the master tries to warn him that, like, you're not going to be saving people, you're just going to be killing people in the hopes that you're killing the right people. And what you're doing is idiotic and foolish. And so the fact that the art of his training is recreated in his like final killing blow is, I guess, is meant as a visual way of bringing that theme around again of like all you can do with the sword is kill people, which is funny because then in the TV show he gets a sword with the blade on the other side and doesn't kill people. It only really becomes an interesting theme during the Kyoto arc where he meets a guy who basically like. He believes that like the strong are meant to live, and so like Kenshin wants to prove him wrong, but how do you prove a guy who wants to die wrong by killing him? Like,
isn't he introduced at the end of this as well?
What's that?
He's the assassin who kills the
That's what I wasn't sure. Yeah, the very, very last assassin. Yeah. Like, he's like, that's I have him. A new assassin, and it shows a guy in the shadows. I thought that was him. That guy, but I wasn't sure.
Pretty sure. Could be wrong, but fairly sure.
No, I think you're right. That's correct. But there is this idea that like that the antagonist from it's going to bother me if I can't remember his name, but the antagonist from the Kyoto arc of the TV series believes that the strong are meant to rule, and so if Kenshin can beat him, then obviously Shishio Makoto is his name, is right, and that Kenshin's meant to win because Kenshin's stronger. And if Kenshin can't kill him, then obviously he's weak and doesn't deserve to rule. And so there is this idea that eventually comes through in the TV show of like how people create and defend and propagate ideologies in a time of violence. But I think it's actually a lot cleaner and more obvious in the OVA, which is a lot more about like how people choose to live and when they choose to die. And these sort of processes that bring people to either a new life or to their awaited death. But
there's a quote really near the start when we're seeing the husband's about to get killed by Kenshin. And he's talking to his patron. He's sort of saying, "Oh, I'm really happy. I'm about to get married, but I feel like I shouldn't be because of all the terrible stuff going on in the world." And the older man says to him, basically, there will always be sort of pain and hatred in the world. You can't let that stop you being happy. And then about 20 seconds later, they're both slaughtered. But
the one thing I did know about Kenshin before I watched this was I knew that he didn't kill. I knew he always used the blunt end of a blade.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of expecting that to sort of play into the OVA somehow at the very end. Like, I was expecting him to sort of fight Tomoe's younger brother and sort of, like, use the blunt end because he didn't want him to die or something like that. But that didn't really come. But that was the only thing that I was expecting that didn't happen.
I kind of liked the fact that that Kenshin's arc towards pacifist is not really the usual one. And that he makes his decision that killing is wrong when they're living together as like fake husband and wife, and he's like, "This is wrong, but I'm going to finish up my time as assassin, and I'll just become a farmer again." Mm-hmm. And then he accidentally kills the woman he loves, and like it destroys him, and then he's like, "Okay, well now I'll finish up my work as an assassin, but I'll definitely."
Yeah,
there are multiple decision points where you think he'd be like, and you like freak out and like realize it's wrong, but he's very much about like finishing his previous commitment to the head of the Chosho clan, and then he's going to become a pacifist.
But he says that to her before, doesn't she? He's always said that I'm gonna stop killing after this whole thing is ended. And then we can live in peace in a farm. Right?
Well, yeah, but what he says when he's with her is like he's like, "I realized I was wrong, and I can't change anything with my sword, so I'm going to finish up what I'm currently involved in, and then I'm going to, and so it's this idea that like he realizes he was wrong, but he's going to finish things out, and then even like the horrific experience of accidentally killing the woman he wants to marry doesn't really change that. There's no like ignition point where he transforms, where his previous worldview is shattered. It's a slow modification that's mostly brought about by the experience of being a killer and then the experience of not killing people than anything else. And I thought that was really interesting.
I'm not sure if you guys got this impression as well, but I got the impression that Kenshin believed that Tomoe was the reason behind the change in himself, but she believed that he naturally was this kind person, and that he was reverting to his true self. He believed that she had changed him, but she believed that he was just reverting to how he already was.
I mean, I'd certainly like his eyes. Like they did a big thing about his eyes, and his eyes, as when he was living with her, they definitely softened up as they were.
Like the eyes are definitely very dead for a very long time in that series. And then as I wrote that down, like on my notes, the next scene it showed his eyes and they were like significantly like more lit up and, you know, sparkly. I was like, oh, okay, well then I guess that is changing. So
yeah, the other thing I really liked is the idea, like, and I feel it's a theme that it's not very well addressed in most media, but I like the theme that, especially for Tomoe's arc of love after love, especially, I mean, the love after love, which happened to be the person who I knew killed my husband. That was a bit, like, weird.
Yeah, that was awkward.
The love after love thing felt was something that I'd never, you don't really see in most media or any. I can only think of one other example, and that's also a manga. That's Natsuyuki Rendezvous. But like, I really like that sort of thing of her, like, especially at the end when the guy was like, "Think of your last husband. Think of your last husband." And she's like, she was kind of like, "No, I don't. Like, I don't care about my last husband. Like, I've made my peace with him. Now, like, I only care about my new love." It was a very interesting theme that isn't addressed in stuff. I also don't know how well it was addressed or how well it was done, because I didn't really. I could see how Kenshin could fall in love with her, especially considering it was kind of planned that he fell in love with her. But I didn't really see how she would fall in love with him. I thought that was, I don't know what it was that changed her, apart from saying, "I will protect you." Like,
I definitely found that awkward, but I guess the logic behind it is that she saw that he was only being used as a tool to kill her previous love, not as a person who chose to do it out of his own malice, and so that sort of made it okay.
No, I mean, I think there's definitely a thing where like she was mostly like she just stayed home and didn't do anything. And the fact that like that there's this idea of taking action on your own recognizance versus taking action because someone else tells you to versus taking no action. And I think that like you said, John, when she saw that when he's not following orders, he is like sweet and patient and protective and shy and a child. Like that's, I think, the first moment when she comes out of the room that next morning. And she's like, "Oh, he's just a child."
And a child, and then later I'll just have sex with him. It's okay. Don't worry about it.
Or just lie naked, and then not sex.
Oh, that's true. They could have just been doing that. It's fine.
They could have just
pure. It's just pure. It's a pure relationship.
Yeah, exactly.
It's fine. Pure as driven snow.
All right, whatever.
So, okay, any closing comments about Rurouni Kenshin, Trust and Betrayal?
Yeah. Was there any particular bits of animation you guys felt stood out for you? Because there are a couple I quickly want to talk about, but I don't know if anyone else has any standout.
The grating one was at the end when they sort of decided to do strobe lighting. That was fun.
Oh yeah, I didn't like that at all.
Times, I think they used it in the in a few fights. I think it's just the idea that it's just whenever he's moving too quick for us to see, that's when they start using that.
They didn't do it in early, though. It was only in the last episode.
Didn't they use it when he was fighting the husband?
I don't think so.
No,
that had one of the weirdest cuts I've ever seen. So, you know, there's the classic two samurais running towards each other, swords about to slash. When they're doing that, and suddenly it cuts to vertical. Did you guys see that?
They flipped his sort of like that
suddenly
was weird.
He's going up the screen, and that was like a really interesting cut. I'm not sure what it did, but it was just like this change of direction and momentum. It was really strange.
That was only because
I kind of liked
it. I like that, and that only could have worked because it was a letterbox screen yeah. instead of now we've got a wide screen. We won't probably be seeing cuts like that again. But I liked
that's it. Sad. That's sort of sad. Mm. There was another part in the second episode which I really liked where you see he's just been told about Tomei carrying a dagger in her kimono, and he's going to her room, and you see the shot of him about to pull his sword out, and it sort of pulls back, and the camera's he's stationary, but the camera's moving, so it's he slowly moves out of shot, and then so there's none of him left, and then his shadow steps forward.
Mm.
Yeah,
and so it goes from the shot of him, and then this shadow moving forward. And I just really like this idea of that you have Kenshin, and then you have like the killer, and this killer sort of steps out as soon as the sword's drawn. And I just really loved that shot. Yeah, it was just a really nice feel to it. It's just this smooth, this sword comes out and then just steps forward.
I agree. I had two that I particularly liked, and the first is kind of an obvious one, but the wood chopping scene,
yeah,
good. And just where every time that the sound's about to come, it cuts to one of his murders, and there's a lot of intercutting where Kenshin's the psychic burden that Kenshin carries of these murders that he's done, is represented in various ways, walking over corpses, etc. But I liked that one especially, and also the small touch. Of the assassins eating snow, and that's how that's meticulously done every time they guy like lands to hide his breath to keep his body temperature low and hide his breath.
Right. Okay. I didn't get
didn't work out for him, but it's just nice, and it's like something that a lot of anime would show once as a weird thing, but the fact that he does it at least three times, like every time he jumps past Kenshin. The sort of meticulousness that in general makes the fights of the assassins like really enjoyable.
Mm. Yeah, that whip chopping scene was really evocative. I really liked that. And it made some of the more sort of gory cuts that I was surprised to be that like visual and visceral. Like that way that played back in, I thought was really powerful. I really liked that. And I like a lot of the scenes where it showed like cuts of people's and like the subtle emotions on their faces. I can't think of like the Shoujo clan. I can't remember. There was one bit where one of the guys was looking and you could see like the disappointment in his eyes. And I thought that was really good. But I honestly can't remember when it was. Because all the names off my head.
There's definitely one shot of Tomoe, which I remember. It was, I can't remember why it happened, but it was like, you see her eyes move, then her face sort of, it's like her eyes subconsciously react to something, and then a couple of moments later you see the rest of her face start to move, and it's like she's consciously reacting to it, and that was really nice. Actually, just a complete sidebar, did anyone else notice the fact that tuberculosis kept cropping up in side characters? Like you had the head of the sort of rebel army confined and coughing up blood, and then you had one of the Shinsengumi also coughing up blood just before a fight with Kenshin. It seemed like those were two quite side characters, but it was like a prominent problem. Do you think that's just because
they're both historical characters who had tuberculosis? Yeah.
Just as simple as ticking that box. No motive.
Shinsaku Takasugi and Okita Soji, both of them had tuberculosis and died prematurely. Actually, Katsura Kogoro, the head of the clan, also died from a lingering illness.
Mm.
It's kind of interesting flavor of almost all of these Bakumatsu things, where you have all these important Japanese figures who are dying of Western diseases because they're the first generation to really get like tuberculosis and typhus imported at like a massive scale.
I was wondering if there's like, because obviously tuberculosis is like this bleeding which can't be stopped, and it's just you keep coughing up blood, and it's, I wonder if that has created like this idea of this sort of tragicness associated with that disease, because it would tend to affect people when they were quite young as well, and whether that and this scar which wouldn't heal are sort of like, those two are connected at all.
I mean, I think that there is definitely a powerful idea of the Bakumonts and this prolonged revolt being just kind of like, yeah, like a wound that won't heal and can't heal until something drastic is done. Because, I mean, this anime didn't necessarily glorify it, but a lot like Hakuoki, which is based on a Otome game, where this girl dates all of the Shinsengumi. It's not good. But yeah, that really plays up just like the fact that this tuberculosis, this coughing, bleeding that will slowly just like tear out your insides. Isn't this so much like our civil war that we're fighting? Without really pointing out that the Shinsengumi are kind of part of the problem in that case, but
I did a little bit of reading up beforehand, and there was the fight we see when the Shinsengumi attack the inn. You're obviously the historian amongst us, Ben. Is it true that that's sort of generally blamed for prolonging the conflict?
I mean, I think that it'd be nice if we have a forum member who knows a lot more about the Shinsengumi than I do. But there is definitely this sensation, this opinion that, yeah, the Shinsengumi were remarkably ineffective. Even though they're celebrated in pop culture, they're mostly a murder squad for reactionaries that cause as much problems like the Ikedaya incident, which we saw, where the Shinsengumi went and murdered 20 Choshi revolutionaries. They prevented the burning of Kyoto, but also basically forced a lot of the moderate conspirators to flee and hide and become more radicalized in the process. And the fact that like no one could control them and they just like walk the streets killing people meant that yeah, I mean there is like everybody's at fault for a lot of what happens during the Bakumatsu, but the Shinsengumi definitely were probably a policy nightmare for the shogunate, since you have a bunch of people basically just murdering anyone they don't think is loyal enough in your name. You could compare it to current tensions on the internet among certain subcultures. It gets hard to.
That's why we need a French Revolution anime.
Yeah, I was actually this director is also known for being the director and writer for Le Chevalier d'Eon, which is
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, which is a very odd anime about
very odd,
but also does take place in the French Revolution. And stars a historical figure who is known for cross-dressing, except in the anime, he/she is a magical person fighting Mercury zombies.
Cool.
There we go. There's
your zombies.
Yeah.
Okay. Well. Should we call it here, guys?
Yeah. Can do.
Okay. Yeah. Why not?
Why not? For an upcoming spotlight, I was thinking that we could do Fooly Cooly, since it's one that keeps being brought up and that we all have a lot of feelings about.
I don't have a lot of feelings.
Well, you need to make some up by the next time you record.
Yeah.
They're allegedly going to remake it. Like,
yes.
Horrendous.
Especially since
there's
the announcement of the production IG possibly doing a remake / sequel / sidequel of it. That'll be interesting to maybe think about a bit, or maybe not, because anime rage over this has been kind of dumb, to be honest.
Actually, I've got an idea. Is there a production IG OVA we could watch as a companion piece to FLCL to make our decision on how terrible an idea this is?
I mean, I don't know about OVAs, but they do Haikyuu, and that's the best sports anime that's ever existed, so...
Because Haikyuu is so
I have the utmost faith in them to make an FLCL remake.
I mean, the problem with the production IG OVA is first, they've made a ton, and second, how do you know which one that they've had enough involvement? Like, they were involved in Ghost in the Shell Arise. They're actually also involved as a secondary studio in Fooly Cooly itself.
Which is also how they got the rights, I
assume. We'll do some research on that, and maybe we'll each bring some stuff to the table. does that sound good?
Yeah, approval? Yeah. Sounds amazing.
Cool, cool.
The other thing, there's a Fooly Cooly manga, which is kind of the same story, but retold in a weird way. So I was just assuming they'd do something like that. Anyway, yes, Fooly Cooly sounds amazing. I can't wait.
Be a little bit more enthusiastic.
No, it's genuinely my favorite anime series, bar One Piece. Like, it's my favorite.
I think it's all right. We'll see if I change my mind.
Mostly because it means that I fell in love with the pillows, as I'm sure loads of other people did.
Oh, that's the main reason that most people have a fondness for them, yes, is Fooly Cooly.
But anyway.
Okay, yes. Well, next we didn't do any reader mail this time around, but we'll have double ready for us next week. So if you want, email us at keyframespodcast@gmail.com.
Get it, because we actually have any.
Yeah. Tweet us at keyframespod. And we have a website that you can go ahead, if you've somehow managed to find these episodes, not through our one venue, since our SoundCloud's kind of defunct. So check that out at keyframespodcast.com.
It also has an RSS feed, which some people like me. I like RSS feeds.
I like RSS feeds too. They're good stuff.
And you can use it to subscribe to our podcast on your normal RSS feed podcast aggregator that you might have on your phone.
And someday we'll be on iTunes, though not today, but check us out there when we
today,
do.
Not today, but someday.
And yeah, that's it. So say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye,
everybody.
Sayonara, reader-chans.